Hello everyone, welcome to the latest Brewin podcast. I'm Ben Gutteridge, Head of Fun Research, and today we're going to be talking about productivity. But please don't turn off, as we have a very entertaining speaker, the FT's undercover economist, famous author and journalist and media pundit, Tim Harford. And here is just a short clip to tell us how he sees and assesses the current climate for productivity.
Just look at computers. They're amazing. Smartphones, they're amazing. Algorithms, artificial intelligence, machine learning. There's so much amazing stuff going on.
Okay, for some more colour on how Tim sees the history of productivity, taking a look at some of the examples from his book and podcast series, 50 Things That Made the Modern Economy, but also a look to see what else could happen in the future to solve this productivity puzzle, please keep listening.
But first, here are our disclaimers.
The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Brewin Dolphin.
Hello everyone, welcome to the latest Brewin podcast. I'm Ben Gutteridge, Head of Fund Research, and today delighted to welcome Tim Harford to speak to us about, well, lots of things really, you know, reviewing all some of the work he's been done and how he's brought economics to life for us. Of course, we are an investment podcast. We may try and bring it back to thinking about how productivity may change into the future, because of course that does seemingly seems to be a bit of an obstruction to economic performance around the world. But anyway, Tim, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
You know, you've been very familiar to many of our listeners, notably your latest work on the 50 Things That Made the Modern Economy. There's obviously a book and a podcast series. I think if we could start, it would just be fascinating for you just to draw out a couple of those examples that, you know, that you found most fascinating, or indeed, you know, our listeners would therefore, you know, really enjoy listening about.
Yeah, it was tremendous fun to work on the project and take a bit of a break from the day job of being a columnist at the Financial Times to take a view on all of these different inventions, and by focusing on different types of technology, different innovations, to learn something about the way the economy works. So I wasn't just saying, wow, cars, they're important. I wanted to say, okay, what does the invention of the barcode teach us about how retail works and how an innovation can reshape the playing field? Because the thing about the barcode, we think of it as being a technology that makes transactions quicker, which it does, speeds up the checkout. But it also solves a lot of problems that big box retailers have and that small corner shops don't really have. So it...
Inventory management.
Managing multiple product lines, so not only food but also managing flowers, managing clothes, managing electronics. So stuff that would just have been too complicated in the old days suddenly becomes much, much easier. Much harder for your staff to steal from you, for example. So there are various things that really, if you're a small shop, is not something you need to worry about. But if you're a big shop, you do worry about. The barcode helps to solve these problems. And therefore, the barcode makes it more profitable to be a big shop and helps to change the balance of power in the marketplace. So one of the points that I make in the series is, and in the book as well, is that a lot of technologies, we think of them as solving a particular problem, and they often do solve a problem. But they solve a problem in a way that reshapes the way the economy works and creates winners and losers. So that's one of the lessons.
I mean, it's quite interesting as well that that shouldn't necessarily have taken, I might get this wrong here, but necessarily taken a huge amount of investment. Perhaps, you know, there's a lot going on behind the scenes, you know, in terms of AI. But I mean, it's sort of quite a simple solution, isn't it? It's not a, you know, what sort of scale of technology has been involved there?
Yeah, well, it was the original idea for a barcode was dates back to just after the Second World War, and a guy called N. Joseph Woodland was pondering, he'd been set a challenge, can you make transactions quicker and cheaper? And he'd gone down to stay with his grandparents, who had a beach property in Florida, I think, and he was sitting on the beach trying to think about this problem, and he pulls his fingers through the sand in this lazy circle, and the sand runs through his fingers, and he looks down and he's created this sort of bullseye shape. And he's also thinking about his time in the Boy Scouts, and using Morse code, and the idea that dots and dashes or ones and zeros can communicate information. And he thinks, well, thick lines and thin lines could do the same thing. So that's the original innovation. And actually, the barcode has been independently invented several times. But you can't do much with that innovation until you have a couple of other things, which are reasonably cheap computers and reasonably cheap lasers. So it just sits there throughout the 50s, throughout the 60s. And it's not until, if I remember rightly, that maybe the late 60s or the 70s, that a workable technology is finally introduced. And then what's interesting is there's this huge argument behind the scenes, because the food manufacturers and the food retailers have different interests. They both want this technology introduced, but they both want the other party to do the investment first, because why do you want to retool your label printing until all these scanners are installed? And why do you want to install these scanners until all the labels have barcodes on them? And what's more, the manufacturers and the retailers had different existing systems, and they wanted the barcodes to fit in with their existing systems. So there was this huge argument that lasted years and years. And I think that it was a correct perception of the fact that the final form of the barcode and the way the system was going to work would advantage one side or another. So it was worth arguing over.
Well, before we move on to modern productivity challenges, one of my favourite examples was the light bulb. I won't tell the story, but it's one of those sort of simple lessons from history about how productivity can change with sort of such a simple idea.
Yeah, so there's a wonderful research paper now about 20 years old by the economist William Nordhaus, who I hope will get the Nobel Prize at some stage. I think he deserves it. Fantastic thinker. And Nordhaus realised something quite simple about light, which is that in a way, light is light is light. You know, there's a unit of measurement, the lumen or the lumen hour, and you can measure illumination. And so you can track the price of illumination through time in a way that it's very difficult to track the price of a lot of other products because they change all the time. So famous problems in computing price indices, if you're going to compare what we buy today with what we might have bought in 1918 or in 1818, the basket of goods is completely different. So it's really hard to compare the standard of living or the progress of technological change or to understand what productivity is really doing. But Nordhaus says, okay, at least if I focus on one thing, if I focus on illumination, I can track the change in the price of light. And what he finds, going way back to how long does it take to chop down a tree, chop it up into pieces and set fire to it and create light that way, through oil lamps, through candles, through whale oil, gas lamps, the early electric light bulbs, and then now modern LEDs. As he tracks the price of all of those things, it's absolutely revolutionary. It's almost impossible to exaggerate how fast the price of light changed from something that it was impossibly expensive to create artificial light a few hundred years ago to being impossibly cheap, something that you just don't even think about. It's effectively, with LEDs, a free resource. And in tracking that, I think he invites us to, first of all, to consider what our inflation and productivity measures are missing, but also he invites us to just be grateful. Technology causes all kinds of problems. In the modern world, there are so many advantages we have that it's easy to take for granted, and he reminds us that we shouldn't.
Well, I wonder on that if we can think about the productivity puzzle that economists and policymakers are wrestling with. I mean, to that point, perhaps, is it the case that would you buy into the thesis that we're not measuring it properly because of the technological advances? For whatever reason, it's just not coming out in the data, and yet we are more productive.
Yeah, I'm not that convinced by the measurement thesis. I mean, there are, in fairness, the reason we call it a puzzle is not because there's no answer to the question of why is productivity so low. It's that there are so many different answers and none of them quite fully seem to fit. I spoke to researchers at the Oxford Martin School recently, and they're investigating 23 different hypotheses for why productivity growth is so slow. And one of the hypotheses is it's not slow, actually. It looks very slow in the data, it looks very disappointing in the data. But one hypothesis is no, it's actually fine. We're just missing all kinds of cool things. We're not fully able to measure them, and it's clear there are some things we can't measure. There's a recent survey by three economists of what people were willing to accept as payment for stopping using Facebook, and what people, what, how much money people were willing to accept as payment for not using email anymore, or maps, or internet search engines, internet video streaming, all of these other digital products. And the numbers were quite high in some cases. I don't fully believe them, but so one measure was social media, maybe $300 a year. Okay, so social media is not that valuable. But email, $6,000 or $7,000 a year. Internet search, $17,000 or $18,000 a year, maybe more, I may have misremembered. I mean, these are big numbers. I mean, that's a third of US GDP. But of course, email and its search are available for nothing. So that's not quite a productivity mismeasurement, but it's certainly this idea there's this huge consumer surplus. But the counter-argument to that is, well, there's always been a huge consumer surplus from new products. Think about Bill Nordhaus, by the way, again, same guy, measured this. He reckoned that innovators tended to get about, if I remember rightly, 4% of the value of their innovation, and most of the rest went to consumers in just lower prices, better products. So you don't fully catch that in productivity. Think about penicillin. I mean, what's the consumer surplus of a few penicillin pills that save your life but cost pennies?
I'm still thinking about how much I'd pay to not use social media.
Yeah, but you know, the idea that, oh, there's something sort of unique about social media, and we've never, television's been around for a while. Television's largely free, funded by advertising. We don't pay for television, don't pay much for television. As I say, penicillin, I mean, so many products are worth an enormous amount and extremely cheap. So I'm not completely convinced by the productivity mismeasurement argument. There's definitely some mismeasurement going on. I'm not convinced that that really fully explains, or even largely explains, why productivity growth has been so slow. I suspect that the productivity slowdown is real. So then we're looking for other explanations for that.
Well, I mean, on that basis, you know, you're a student of economic history, and you've explained in such a colourful way how the productivity has, how productivity has advanced. You know, do you have much optimism into the future about the pace of transformation?
So I am an optimist, generally. I think not for rational reasons. I'm just an optimist by nature. I think the best argument that the best way to resolve the puzzle, which is that, well, just look at computers. They're amazing. Smartphones, they're amazing. Algorithms, artificial intelligence, machine learning. There's so much amazing stuff going on. How is it that productivity growth is so slow? The best resolution of that puzzle is, I think, to say, just wait. So one resolution is to say productivity growth is slow, so tough. Another is to say, these things are actually not amazing after all. But I think the most logical way of looking at it is to say they are amazing, but we haven't really fully worked out how to use them. They haven't fully been absorbed into the economy. We haven't restructured what we do fully yet. And in due course, we will really see the impact. So to give you a couple of examples of things that we might see, one way of understanding artificial intelligence is not, oh, the Terminator's coming to take your job. Artificial intelligence is a source of very cheap predictions. So you want to get to the airport, artificial intelligence will tell you how long it's going to get to the airport. We don't, of course, the moment it becomes routine, we don't call it artificial intelligence anymore. We just call it a smartphone, Google Maps. But it's artificial intelligence. It's making a prediction. It's got new data that we couldn't previously have accessed. It's got algorithms for plotting the best route, and it tells us how long it's going to take to get to the airport. Think about that. Well, that starts to influence demand for things like airport lounges. An airport lounge is a thing that you have because you don't know how long it's going to take you to get to the airport, or how long it's going to take you to get through the airport, or when your plane's going to take off, and so you need to leave plenty of time. And so you sit around in an airport lounge. If you get good enough predictions, you can just cut it fine, arrive at the airport, go through security, and you walk straight on the plane because the computer got it right. Another example, what's a fridge or a freezer if not a way of allowing for the fact that I don't know quite what I want to eat, when I want to eat, so I need some stuff in storage. If the supermarket knows when I'm likely to eat, because it looks at my digital calendar, because it talks to my fridge, and makes a prediction, and starts shipping me stuff that I haven't ordered, because it has a good enough prediction that it knows I will want them, usually want them, and be happy to receive them, then the fridge starts to get smaller. So this sort of, I mean, and multiply this by 10,000, and maybe that's where it's going. And maybe that's where the productivity revolution is coming from. But these things always take time. If you look at the history, it's a very famous example, the history of electrification in American manufacturing. Should have happened in the 1890s. The technology was there. Didn't really happen until the 1920s. Didn't show up in the productivity statistics until the 1920s. And the reason that there was a third of a century delay, I mean, this is 35 years. It's a long time to wait. The reason there was such a delay is because you had to reconfigure the processes, retrain the workers, build different kinds of factories to take full advantage of the new electric motors. Basically, everything about the process needed to change. And then once that had changed, suddenly electric motors are extremely productive. So it just takes time for us to adjust.
I mean, would you put much stock in the idea that things like, you know, is there any sort of tangible ideas out there that could be really good for productivity, whether it's driverless cars, or so we can all just sort of sit and work in our cars, or whether it's longer life batteries? I mean, are these things that you think about that could feature in the future in one of your books as changing the economy?
Well, I mean, a really good battery would make a huge difference. I mean, driverless cars, let's leave those to one side. They've been very, very well discussed by lots of other people. I don't have any particular insight into them. Obviously, they would change a lot if you had a driverless car. You start renting, and it becomes your office, it becomes your gym, it becomes your your entertainment center, and you rent them, you don't own them. So that would be intriguing. But batteries, the huge thing about batteries is the price of solar photovoltaic energy seems to be having a Moore's Law moment. Moore's Law, the famous law about how much cheaper computing power gets. Every forecast that's been made in the last few years, even the most rosy, has proved to be too pessimistic. The price of solar panels is just collapsing, and there seems to be more on the way. I'm not an expert in this technology, but I'm told that they're just about to start printing solar panels cheaply on, you know, rolls of acetate, effectively. So thin sheets of plastic, you just put them on the outside of a building, put them on the roof of a car, very, very cheap. So the price is falling and falling and falling and falling. Most of the world's population lives closer to the equator than we are now. We're in Edinburgh. Actually, most of the world's population lives closer to the equator than London. It's very easy in the UK to forget that. There's a lot of sun around. So lots of sun, cheap electricity, really cheap electricity. What you need then is a way of managing the mismatch of when you're generating the electricity and when you might want to use it. And there are various ways to do that, but batteries are part of that. So if you've got a really good set of batteries, whether it's the lithium-ion batteries we're used to, or it's something more esoteric like using ice as a store of energy, or using molten salt as a store of energy. The moment you've got that and all this cheap solar power, energy becomes very, very, very cheap indeed. And if that happens, which it seems like it might, I think there are so many things we can do with almost limitless cheap energy with no serious environmental consequences. That would be a real game changer.
Okay, well, Tim, thank you so much for your time. Really, really fascinating stuff, and you bring everything to life. I mean, just a reminder to our listeners of how they can keep in touch with everything you're saying. Like we said, there's a book out, a podcast series. Anything else you want to talk about?
Yeah, so my name is Tim Harford, H-A-R-F-O-R-D. So I'm at Tim Harford on Twitter. TimHarford.com is my website. I'm in the Financial Times every Saturday. And my radio show is More or Less on the BBC. And the most recent book, 50 Things That Made the Modern Economy.
Okay, well, we look forward to picking up a copy of that. I can't let you go without asking you what's going to do better this year, US equities or European equities.
I have absolutely no idea.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Tim. We really appreciate your time. Fascinating conversation. And we will be sure we follow your work closely. So thanks again. And to our listeners, thanks very much for listening. Let us know what you think on iTunes, leave a review on SoundCloud, on website, or on Twitter, referencing hashtag Brewing Podcast. But until next time, many thanks for listening.
Thank you.